Well, it's, I think, pretty damn obvious. I don't think it particularly looks good for Donald Trump. A number of administrations had considered the possibility of separating parents and children at the border and rejected it because it was clearly inhumane. Not Donald Trump. And one of the most appalling aspects of this policy is there were arguments about keeping records. Okay, let's separate the children, but let's not f actually keep a record of how to ever reunite them. Let's separate them for good. Let's just create orphans, abandoned children. To me, it's the most appalling part of the policy. It's a policy, if one hasn't noticed this, in all of Donald Trump's rhetoric, it's a policy of meanness.
Errol Morris,
You
we're going
can
to have to
say
leave
it's
it there.
deterrence, you can say it's this, you can say it's that, but at its heart, it's a policy of meanness.
So, Separated is premiering tonight at IFC here in New York City, has a week-long run, and then it's going to be on MSNBC, but after the election?
It'll be on in December. We're going to get the theatrical release out of the way first, and I'm excited for people to see it whenever and wherever they can see it.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Jacob Soboroff is author of Separated and is one of the stars of the film Separated, directed by Errol Morris. Happy birthday to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity, and inclusion. If your business aligns with these values, underwriting on KBOO is an effective way to reach an engaged audience. Take advantage of the best rate and audience in Portland by going online to kboo.fm/underwriting. That's kboo.fm/underwriting.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show. I am your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. The voices of Palestinians in Gaza are some of the most censored in the world. If they're not killed outright, they are silenced by purposeful omission in order to support Israel's narrative. It is therefore vital that alternative media work to find and platform these voices, and that people who are not easily fooled by pro-Israel propaganda engage with it, share it, and allow it to inform our actions. This week, we sit down with Dr. Khalil Khalidi, an orthopedic doctor in Deir al-Balah, Gaza. His testimony is necessary and powerful and understandably distressing. We are therefore here including a content warning for this week's show, as Dr. Khalidi does not sugarcoat his lived experiences. The following program includes descriptions of an ongoing genocide, of psychological and physical suffering from the perspective of a doctor trying to work in abominable conditions with little to no supplies. Coming up now on Project Censored.
Ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach on potential.
Dr. Khalidi, I was wondering if you could tell people where you are in the Gaza Strip and what the situation is like at this current moment. We're recording this on Wednesday, September 18th, 2024.
So Gaza Strip is literally a small strip, as you said. Like before this event, I used to do marathons, like charity marathons, and we would go from the top north to the top south in 2.5-3 hours by like running not at like a very fast speed, like you can say 20 kilometers per hour. So it's very, very small. Currently, I am in the middle, district, in Deir el-Balah, the last safe, quote-unquote, safe zone, as instructed by the IDF. And right now, the situation is very shaky, unstable. There is a lot of bombings happening, especially in the safe zone. I'm sure you've heard of the last few massacres happening in tents and how people were buried alive because of the explosions. Schools have been targeted like 4 days ago. A school in the middle area in Nusayrat camp was bombed. Four UN teachers who were volunteering to help with the refugees and distribute aid got killed, along with plenty of families. Yesterday and by dawn, there was an artillery attack with tanks bombing a residential area at the east of the middle district in Burej camp. 7 families were killed. So yeah, the safe, quote-unquote safe zone is not so safe. When it comes to food and when it comes to supplies, we are very short, obviously. Many of the supplies and many of the food comes to us from the Israeli side after their approval, and most of it is sold to us. The aid is crammed on the border. Most of it doesn't get to us, and the few that does get to us is not fairly distributed, and most of it gets sold to us after it's been stolen as well. Disinfectants are not existent or very, very rare. So we resorted to improvising, using the traditional methods of crafting soap as we used to do. We are the Palestinians, so well known for our olive oil soap. We call it the Nablusi soap. So we start making our own soap. We use herbs. We recycle materials to use it. Hospitals are barely functioning. We don't have any supplies. We don't have any medicine. Like down to the most basic of medicine and most basics of needs, like dressing, analgesics, simple over-the-counter analgesics, we don't have them.
In your work as an orthopedic doctor, what do you have to use when you try to help people?
When I have an injury, I would literally use what I have, which is what's on the patient mostly. So at some point, some of the patients will still have some like clothes torn apart or barely covered with something. So I will use it, I will wash it, and I will drench it in disinfectant, which we made locally. And I will use it as padding or as dressing for their wounds. We will take some cotton and we will make it as padding for the cast. I will use recycled casting materials to stabilize fractures and to fix them into positions. When it comes to the surgeries, we don't have surgical gowns, let alone sterile ones. So we just operate on a table as it is, which makes like rates of infection and rates of spread of complications very, very high. So yeah, it's very challenging. It's hard to describe right on the spot. And I'm trying to give you an idea of what it might look like. You want to cook something, but you don't have the ingredients. So you improvise with a pretend game of that you cook something. It's like when you play with a 5-year-old or 6-year-old and you pretend to have a tea party while you don't have the tea. That's how our work feels like. Very frustrating because you know how to deal with such thing, and it's very, very preventable and very easily treated, extremely easily treated. But there are no resources, there are no equipment, there are no facilities. So you just stand there and you feel sometimes useless or sometimes like you've been chained to a wall, chained or shackled and you cannot reach for something. That's how it feels like. Yeah.
And you mentioned the infection. Do you have anything to treat that? Do you have antibiotics? Do you have pain medication? Do you have any kind of medication to give people?
We have basic antibiotics and we use them when the infection is very severe and is very rampant. Most of the cases that we have infections because it's been going for so long, most of the bacteria that we'll deal with are resistant to these regular antibiotics. So what we would resort to, either amputate or either, as we call it, debridement, which is cutting off the flush that's been infected in hope that the new flush doesn't get infected. And most of them get lost, pass away due to that complication. And it doesn't get counted in the death toll because it's not the direct death toll. The direct death toll that's been announced here by the Ministry of Health is the retrieved bodies that's been identified. That's it. That's the number. The 40,000 are the people that they've been identified with retrieved bodies, dead on the spot. Not the people that died from infection, not the people that died later on because of other complications, not the people that haven't been identified yet, the unknowns, not the people that are still stuck on the rubble and recorded as missing. These are not included in the statistics or the list that's been published lately, like 4 days ago, by the Ministry of Health.
And of course, you have people who were sick before October 7th who then couldn't get treatment that have died, and they're, of course, not counted either, I'm assuming.
That's another story. That's another story. We have the direct death toll. We have the direct death toll, which means that people who have been killed directly and arrived dead, and only those who were identified and retrieved were included in the statistics. And we have the indirect or preventable death toll, which is basically people with chronic illnesses, people with cancer or heart attack or diabetes, or children who died from dehydration or dealing with malnutrition and such and such and such. And many of the newly delivered babies, newborns are born with CB, because the delivery is very delayed and there are many complications and it's very primitive. So nobody talks about that. And add to that, there are plenty of disabilities and plenty of life-altering, like irreversible damage to people that's not being talked about as well. And part of the statistics in which we discuss about statistics, even my people, in our part, because we have been dehumanized so much to the point that we don't include men, or we refer to men as something negligible in the statistics, and we don't pay like much attention to that, to the fact that these men are the providers, are the protectors, are the helpers, and these men will be the ones taking care of the children and the women. So you have in the statistics being announced, they say you have this death toll, half of which are women and children, this percentage are elderly, and we have men. As if we confirm to the narrative that these men are the fighters, these men are the terrorists, these men deserve what happened to them. Meanwhile, these men are the people who you see in the hospital carrying people from under the rubble, digging with their own hands. You see these men standing in line to get water or to get food for their family. These men are the ones who are building tents. These men are the ones who are protecting the children and the women from the stray animals, from thieves, and getting them the medicine, or try to get them medicine and treatment, and carrying them back and forth, and responsible for the transport of these people. So that's another issue that nobody talks about it enough, which is the men of Gaza.
Thank you for highlighting that. I've long felt that it was really disgusting that we did not talk about the men And I wanted to ask you a bit more about the supplies. You said that Israel has to confirm whether they can come through. Where do they come through? And are there any ways to get supplies that don't come from Israel, like the Rafah border with Egypt? Are there other ways that you are able to get supplies?
Nothing at all. Right now, Rafah has been taken over and the northern border has been taken over. And it's literally an enclosure, like a prison enclosure, or literally it's a concentration camp. We're not going to sugarcoat it. It's a concentration camp. And nothing gets in, nothing gets out unless the IDF approves it, including supplies, including aid, including medicine, including the people that come in and go out. And currently nobody gets out unless they are within a medical mission in coordination with the WHO, or unless they are cancer patients or severely wounded children. And that part of the severely wounded children, we're going to talk about it later, has many concerns about it. When it comes to supplies, as I told you, nothing comes in unless it's approved by the IDF. And most of it are supplies that are not essential for survival. Like you will see sometimes they send us ramen noodles, instant ramen noodles, packets to feed on, which is literally, it's toxic. Many of the canned food is only, the canned food would expire within 2 months or 3 months. So you don't have the chance to save up, or you don't have the chance to store it. Sometimes they will send us frozen chicken wings or frozen meat. And they know, it's very sadistic because they know we don't have fridges. They don't know we don't have electricity. So that meat has to be eaten within a day or within 2 days. The supplies that we receive are being sold to us with 10 times or 10 folds the price. Like a bar of soap is approximately $7. Shampoo will cost $50 to $60.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with orthopedic doctor, Dr. Khalil Khalidi in Gaza.
So pricing, there's a point that I will have to note and tell the people abroad about. We have two situations here in Gaza Strip. We have the north of Gaza and we have the south of Gaza. And they are separated. The north of Gaza is million times harder to live in than the south of Gaza. Barely they will get a truck or two every month or so. And the prices there are 100 times than the prices in the south. So the north of Gaza, a tomato, one tomato will cost up to $30. The north is absolutely starved to death. It's part of the sadistic psychological torture that they put on us, in which I am in front of the world. I am allowing them food. Let them eat food. Oh, look, the tomato in the north is rotting. They don't tell the world that this tomato is literally $20 or $30, and they cannot sustain to have a tomato for the whole family. It's like the bits of hell. The north, the more north you go, the deeper in hell you go.
You had mentioned that you wanted to come back to the point of severely wounded children, and I was hoping you could describe that a bit more.
So here's the thing. Because I am in the hospital and I deal with many severely wounded children, we have this term in Gaza and Gaza only, and we've been having that term since 2008, from the first ever aggression. We've had so far 9 to 10 aggressions every few months to few years. Planes come and attack and bomb and kill people. And it's referred in their own terms as mowing the lawn, in which they kill some of us so we don't overpopulate, to save us from overcrowding in the beautiful prison that they put us in. So the term wounded child, no surviving family, means that the child has been severely wounded and they are the only survivor or the sole survivor of the family. these children are being taken out for treatment, further treatment by NGOs, by institutions, under the approval of the IDF. And they compare it to the children that have been taken about or evacuated during the Holocaust in World War II. These children have no guarantee of coming back. Many of them have no communication with the remaining survivors of their family, their relatives, aunt, second cousin, third cousin. They have no communication with them. And their destiny or their future is completely unknown. And many of them, we lose track of them as like doctors and as people, as physicians who used to treat with them and to attend them, because we essentially adopted them in the hospital. Many of the children became our own, in which they live with us in the hospital. We share the food with them. We laugh with them. We play with them and such before they were taken away. And after that, neither us nor anyone would have direct contact with them. Sometimes children with, like, you have the mother severely wounded, not approved to come have treatment, to go have treatment abroad, and the children is taken away from her, but they have no connection or no means of communication between them. And that's very concerning, because it's paraded as like a virtuous act, while in fact, we have no idea what's going on. Are these children being taken, being trafficked? Are these children being taken to be raised up as people from another society? Or are these children aware of their own origin, of their own history? And that tracks back to the history of many cases of ethnic cleansing. And we have no choice about it, because it's either that child die, or how would they live and where would they live? You don't know. And you just hope for the best.
Thank you for pointing all that out. It is, of course, very twisted. And I'm glad that you used the term ethnic cleansing, because ripping a child away from their own history and their culture is ethnic cleansing, just like we've seen in the United States with the indigenous population here. And I wanted to ask you, you said that a bomb just went off. Obviously, the safe zone means nothing. But how often are there bombings where you are? I mean, I assume you're in your home right now. How often are there bombings where you are?
Very often, like every few minutes. I'm not sure if my phone picks it or does noise cancellation or something like this. But you can hear clashes right now. There is the buzzing of the drone, and there is bombing every like 20 to 30 minutes. That's another point, that they play it as a video game. So whenever they board, the tanks just launch randomly, like throw bombs or throw missiles randomly, whether it's a home or a land or just random, it doesn't matter, because it's a playground for them, literally. And many people from the IDF had posted about it and talked about it, how fun it is. And we have this rule here. If you hear a drone, you are safe, because the drone is here to inspect and record. And once the drone comes silent, there is a bomb coming that the target has been like locked in. And if you hear the bomb, you are safe. As you can tell, I heard a bomb, but I didn't like bother checking or what. Because yes, the bomb, if I hear it, it's not on me, so I'm good. As long as you hear a sound, you're good. But once you don't hear the sound is when you are very, very worried. It means that it's very close to you or on you. And people who have survived always tell us that. I will be sitting and I will just hear like an air vacuum, kind of sit like this sound. And I will go blank, and I will wake up in the hospital or wake up by people pulling me from the rubble. And that's, or you wake up in heaven, one of the three. So that's our rule. If you hear a sound, you're good. If you don't hear a sound, be worried. And to teach that to a child, that's another story. Because I don't know how our children grasp it or our children views it, but they know this rule very well. And I'm telling you this rule because we simplify it to the kids to not be worried. Okay, you hear the sound? Good. But once the drone comes silent, you have your child or your cousin or any child in the hospital rushing to you and hugging you and telling you, I love you, you know, can I come or sit next to you? Because they know once things get silent, there's something dropping. And that's how the children deal with it or how the children survive this. Survive. I don't know a better term to say how they go through it. But yeah.
They cope, I guess. I wanted to ask you about that too, because I saw a video where you were speaking about the difference between post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic stress disorder. And I was wondering if you could share a bit about that.
So in psychology, I had a diploma in psychology, trying to help the people because we are in dire need of something called psychological first aid, which is how to make people at least calm down during high stress situation or a panic attack. And one of the concepts that are like very common, pretty common, commonly known in the world for not even people who are very well oriented in the world of psychology or the science of psychology is post-traumatic disorder, a PTSD. But it's rarely talked about when it comes to it happening over and over and over with the stress or with the threat being persistent for a long period of time. So a PTSD is when you deal with a trauma, you have a stressful situation, and after that, your brain starts to process it because it wants to heal from it. So you start to process it, and that comes in with the symptoms that should have been happening during that instance. And you start healing and you start acknowledging, facing your fear, dealing with the trauma, having closure and such and such and such. When it comes to continuous traumatic stress disorder, the threat is persistent. And you have a trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma. So after a while, your brain becomes so used to high levels of stress hormone, which is cortisol. And it becomes pretty much dependent on it. The centers of the brain or centers of your psyche and the parts of your psyche, that are responsible for healing or processing such events becomes less and less active and less prominent. So your perception of reality and perception of what goes on becomes dulled and numb. And that's what you see with people who have been through prolonged periods of conflict, in conflict zones. And that creates a society that's been internally dehumanized, not just externally. And part of it are like the symptoms of it. As I told you, you have our government or the people of the Ministry of Health not acknowledging men as men. It's because they have been so psychologically abused, trying to prove that they are human to the point that they gave up on men so they can approve to the world that, yes, okay, men, done case, we are over it, they are terrorists, kill all the men. At least save the children, save the women. You have people working here, like feeling the need to perform like animals in a circus to garner attention and to garner support or to garner like financial aid or something like this. So you see people posting their children dancing, posting their children laughing, trying to confirm to the narrative that they are the resilient people, the people of hope. So you see our people, because of this continuous traumatic stress disorder, feeling cornered or feeling obligated to perform that they are okay. And in psychology, there is a common saying we say to people who are going through depression, people facing mental illness and mental disorders, that it's okay not to be okay. We always tell them this. It's okay not to be okay. You can tell us that you are not okay. You can ask for help. That doesn't make you any less. But when it comes to us, it's you are not okay and you don't have the right not to be okay. Because the minute you start complaining, the minute you start making people uncomfortable, they were going to withdraw from you. They are going to ignore you. They are going to deem you as sensitive or deem you as negative or deem you as someone who is a Debbie Downer. And they will go to the person who is performing this performance of, yes, I am the resilient one. I am smiling despite the pain. Because that makes people comfortable. That makes people feel less guilty. They'll be like, yes, they are going through hardship, but yeah, they are doing fine. They don't need me. I don't need to worry about it. Let me just send them money and that's it. And they will be fine. And the second point of that, in 1948, when the first Nakba started, people got displaced into camps here in Gaza Strip. And they lived in tents. And because it was going for so long, these tents couldn't stand the rain, couldn't stand the sun exposure, couldn't stand all the environments and such. So people started building houses, and these houses turned into actual buildings, and actual buildings turned into cities. So the cities that you see in your footage, or the cities that you see in your videos and social media or in the news, are camps. Jabalia, Beit Hanun, Nusayrat, Rej, Deir el-Balah, Khan Yunis, Rafah, they are all used to be camps. So for me to witness that people are starting to embellish their tents and starting to build like walls or use rubble to make housing, quote unquote, it's so alarming. It means that what's been done is done and you're not going to return to the way you were. You are being displaced again. Each and every family will have the key to their house that they lost in 1948. And now we have two keys. We have the key of 1948 and the key of 2023 or 2024. We are being conditioned that this displacement is irreversible. You have no hopes of return. That land is being lost forever. And you have the officials on the other side, on the Israeli side, starting to auction land there. So that's something that's not being discussed and not being looked at and not being addressed, because people here are under continuous stress, traumatic stress disorder. How can you talk about such thing when you are still trying to survive, or when you're trying to have something over your head, or dodging a bomb, or checking if there is a safe area or not? And they are deliberately using so. If you follow the news, every week or so, they launch a new map of leave here, go there. Leave there, go here. So it's a constant, constant state of insecurity and of fear, of instability. And they want us to stay in that round so we don't have the awareness, or we don't look into what they are doing in the bigger picture.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Khalil Khalidi after this brief musical break, so please stay with us.
بس الجرح اللي فتحته عبيته التراب وزرعته ورود في شباك سنيني طلع وادي انام بليل وفي برداني الشتا نزلوا سقاني لمس ودروس ومعاني بس البحر اللي قطعته قد ما عشقته تركته عالأفق يدور والجرح اللي فتحته عبيته التراب وزرعته مش شايفته في بداخلي أطفال بعدني مش خلقتهم في بداخلي أغاني بتدق الباب كل ما تحس الاكتئاب عم يخنق في طفل جواتي الدلع.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with orthopedic doctor, Dr. Khalil Khalidi in Gaza.
I think it's so important that people understand Palestinian history, particularly here in the U.S., so that they understand the original Nakba and the layers of this traumatic stress so that we can also be ones who don't forget. I think that is our job, especially as people in the United States. And I don't want to keep you too long, because if you don't have to save lives, I imagine you do need to try to sleep or be with your family. But I am curious, because you obviously are so multi-talented. I mean, you're an orthopedic doctor, you have a diploma in psychology, but you're also a brilliant artist. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you've used art in order to keep stories alive when you can't keep people alive.
I consider myself one of the lucky ones, or one of the blessed ones, to have the gift of awareness and to have the gift of what they call that I had my griefing, what my potential life would have been has it not be due to this. And it's been going prior to this. It started around 2019, 2020, when I've noticed that, yes, I am considered less of the other people around the globe. I am denied certain opportunities. I am prevented from rights, many rights. And you start this, it goes throughout the full grieving process of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance. And then comes after that, yes, it is what it is. What can I make out of it? What's my purpose in it? So prior to that, my art was focused on what we talked about, the performance aspect, but it was going through not just performing for the sake of performing, but it was going to proving that I am human enough. And the value of someone is not related to their appearance or where they come from or their ancestry or their past. So that's how my art was focused on. And after that, my art started getting around a few period, like for a short period of time, pretty angry, because I was going through the grief process. So it was pretty angry. So it was like, not angry in a way of rejecting hate or baking slogans or smearing other populations or other people or certain group. It was angry in a way of, why don't you see this? Why cannot you see what I'm seeing or understand what I'm trying to say or understand what I'm trying to express? And I felt so gaslit about it, because I didn't announce that I am a Palestinian or I live in Gaza. I didn't announce any of it. And I made my art speak for itself. And I am thankful for that, because it made me understand the other perspective around the globe. Many people who saw my art reacted to it from the perspective of their own societies and from the perspective of their own experience. And it was between 2019 to 2022. So epidemic happened, Black Lives Matter movement happened, Sheikh Jarrah events happened, the Uyghur genocide was gaining more and more publicity. Congo started to rise and have more awareness about the Congo. So you open your eyes and see, okay, I am not alone in this. I experience oppression. Many people, everyone around the globe, experience oppression. Why are not they aware of it? And that's when my direction started coming to, let's make my experience not talk about my experience itself, but make it raw emotions rather than talking about the event itself, a date or a certain situation or a certain name and such. Make it a feeling. And that's what I did lately with the 991 painting that I painted with a unknown child. So I didn't want to put photographs of the child or say that this child had this and this. I want people to be uncomfortable and to understand what it's like to lose your child. Not only lose your child, but your child is going to die alone. And what's your actual reaction about it? Are you going to react as, yes, it's yet another number? Because that's how you deal with people, with dehumanized societies, such as us, such as people in Congo, people in Sudan, people in the Uyghur, in Ukraine as well. People, they are just numbers. You see, it had moved from numbers to estimated numbers even. You see in the news, an estimated 15. What about the 16? Or are you just estimating? These are like, and I want to try to deliver that emotion. And what I've done with my painting about the ice cream trucks of Gaza being used to store deceased bodies and cadavers, and what kind of impact would a child, assault surviving child, have to have their whole family pulled from an ice cream truck, something that used to bring them joy and is supposed to be their happy place and happy memory when they grow up, to see their whole family being taken out of the ice cream truck. You see the impact on us. We call it just the morgue right now. So you have a child calling it like that, the cadaver van, they call it, pulling out of it, and they are like laid in front of that child, not only their family, but everyone in that truck, in hopes that the child will recognize some of them. So you have children looking at dead bodies, not only their family, but other people. And they are not dead in the sense that we see in movies and such, like peacefully of natural causes dead, but mutilated dead. So that's what I'm trying to express during my art right now, is to never forget, never forgive, and never again. We want to break that cycle, no matter what. We want it to end with us, and no other people after us have to experience such, because the damage has been done, as you can tell as we are speaking. The damage has been done psychologically, physically. The infrastructure of the city is wiped out. Memories has been done. Families has been wiped out from the civil records. So it's irreversible, and we don't want any other nation, any other group of people to have to witness that. And that's what I'm trying to express in my recent art project, and my direction with art is just, I want the world to understand. I want the world to be accepting of the idea that emotions such as sadness, grieving, anger, disappointment, fear, I want these emotions to be normalized. I don't want them to be something that's uncomfortable for people to just ignore or to escape from or to seek to heal from. If you're not angry when your fellow human is facing injustice, when would you be angry? If you're not sad for the loss of innocent lives, when would you be sad? These emotions are here for a reason. And I really hope I can portray that in my upcoming projects and my upcoming artworks, for people to actually grasp the idea and project on it on their own societies. Because, for example, freedom, the concept of freedom, America is the land of the free. And it's named so, but I can see your smirk of like, yeah, right. And I understand. I understand very well, because we are forced to understand your history, and we are forced to understand your society and your culture for us to survive. So I consider myself having a very clear idea of what it's like to be in America, Of course, not the full perception. I've never lived there, never seen there. From what I've seen, and because the American culture is so vast and so out there, and it's considered the common practice in movies, in cinemas, and such, so it gives you an intel. But yeah, America is considered the land of the free, yet I don't see freedom at all. You see candidates performing a circus act, essentially. And everyone in America knows it, yet nobody is having the ability to say, or the right to say, let's put them both down and let's select new candidates that are worthy and they are qualified enough. These two are clearly disqualified, so let's start over. But no, because it's built on a system, and that system is built on benefit, and it's built on capitalism and built on industrialism. So once you start to tear that down, many people will oppose you or stand against you, because many are benefiting from this chaos and benefiting from that system to the point that they will kill to have that system stay and survive. So sometimes I told my people, my friends there who live in America and other countries, I believe that we are more free than you. Like, you are afraid to lose your jobs, you are afraid for your identity to be noticed at some protests and such, because you will be chased down and you will be persecuted, or you will be frowned upon and you will lose many opportunities and such in the name of freedom. And many brave souls were not afraid, and we command them. But yes, it is a fact that that's not absolute freedom. My freedom lies in, and I'm not afraid to lose my job. I'm not afraid to lose my house. I'm not afraid to lose my city, because it's been gone already. There's nothing to lose. You have nothing to lose other than what you have. So that itself gives us some sort of freedom. And we also have, like, sometimes I jokingly say that us, by existing, we revoke each and every victim card ever used in humanity, because we understand what it's like to have most sorts of oppression. We understand what it's like to be discriminated against for something, for simply being who you are.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with orthopedic doctor, Dr. Khalil Khalidi in Gaza.
We understand what it's like to be discriminated against for your religion, what it's like to be discriminated against for your ethnicity. We know what it's like to be treated as a slave, to work for nothing except to get some crumbs of food, to be treated as a number, to not have a name, to be treated as a subhuman, to be referred as an animal, literally. We understand what it's like to be unrecognized for what you do, or unappreciated for what you do. We understand what it's like to be gaslit when you try to express what goes on, or try to tell the world what goes on, and you are being gaslit, that you are being delusional, or that you are to blame and you are part of the problem. And it's been going for 75 years, and barely the world is waking up and starting to awake to the fact that, yes, oh, you've been facing this for 75 years? You have been occupied? You are being ethnically cleansed? Oh, yes, we have been saying so for 75 years. We have been screaming about it. We are constantly being said, oh, it's too complicated of a topic to be discussed. It's too political. You are to blame. You are the ones who don't want the peace. You are the ones who are not giving in. You are the ones who are being aggressive. You are the uncivilized people. Which, thankfully, there's a shift and there is more awareness about it, but it's hard to recover from at once, and change will never happen at once. And with that comes a fear of ours, in which it's a passing trend, in which it happened over and over. for the past aggressions, there was a movement and there was an awareness and there was protests about what goes on. But the moment a ceasefire happens or a truce happens, back to square one, and it's normal. And we hope that this is not the case and that more people are like awake to what goes on. So yes.
It shouldn't have to take a genocide for that to be the case. And Dr. Khalidi, I know that you've been very generous with your time, and I just wanted to ask if there's anything else that you'd like to share about your current situation, about experiences, or anything else that you'd like people, predominantly people in the United States, to know or even to do.
To tell a story, I don't have like a direct story on top of my head, but what can you do? What can you do is, there are three, as for the lack of a better term, three triggering sentences that are being repeated over and over again to us in response of what we go through. And it comes from a very good place and from a genuine place of caring and wanting to help and wanting to check on us and such, but I want to bring awareness to it that one of the sentences is like, oh, okay, I hope you are okay and I hope you haven't lost someone. Each and everyone in here has lost at least 5 to 6 people, their family, or their friends, or their neighbors. So don't say, I hope you didn't lose someone, because sometimes it opens wounds and many haven't grieved it and haven't faced it yet. When another sentence, when people say, oh, I'm sorry I haven't contacted you for a while, or I'm sorry I haven't spoken with you for a while, I was taking a break from the scenery and from the footage that I see. Yes, that's your right. And that's a very healthy thing to do, that you have to take care of your mental health. Don't tell me that my existence makes you uncomfortable. Don't. Because you will see many people being like, I am sorry that we are dying. What would my response be? And the third response is, I am sorry that you go through this. I wish I could do something. Yes, you can do plenty of things. It starts with educating yourself. It starts with starting conversations and talks. I'm not saying go to protest. I'm not saying go scream on top of their lungs or share footage, graphic. No, don't. But after you educate yourself, start conversations in your circles, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, with your friends, when you go out. Like, start that conversation. Educate others the same way that you educated yourself. And also, don't support hate speech. Don't support things that, I don't know if it's legal in your state or not, but many states it's been legal, the word boycott. So try to do that as much as you can, because it helped and it does have an effect. And try to check as much as you can on people. If you have contact with people on the ground, whether they are people working there, have some sort of communication with them, start conversations with them. Try to make it casual and normal. Don't make it as you feel pity for them, or don't over romanticize what they go through as the heroes, or because it creates that narrative, and that narrative weighs down on that person to try to fit into that narrative. So it will turn into an unintentional gaslight situation to the people here. So just have conversations with them, make them feel heard, make them feel like not alone, that they are remembered, that you care for them. So these are things that you can do. Easy things, I hope, not so demanding. That's it, I believe.
Thank you for... I'm also kind of amazed that people will say those things to you, but I guess I've lost my ability to be shocked in a lot of ways.
it comes like we are in the term of educating one another. And if it wasn't for communication, we wouldn't understand such things. And this conversation had been had prior with many, many other things. Like you in America, I'm sure you had conversations about what's proper to say to a Black person, what's not proper. The Asian people, people with mental illness, people who are of the LGBT community and such, there are plenty of things that are proper and improper to say, and they are known so because we've had conversations about it, which we are in right now. And I really hope people who listen to this or watch this start to understand that, yes, we understand that it's coming from a genuine place and coming from a kind-hearted intention. But please see our perspective, and there are better ways to say it. Like, instead of, I hope that you are okay, I hope that you haven't lost someone, are you okay? Start with the conversation of, are you okay? An open question. Instead of saying, I'm sorry, there is nothing to do, we have talked about, yes, there are things to do. And if you cannot do them, just don't say that I cannot do nothing. And the third one, I took a break because I couldn't handle the footage or the scenery. Just say I was busy, I was dealing with some stuff. I hope that you are well. Tell me, give me an update of what you're going through. These are my updates. That will be more appropriate and more helpful, I believe.
I mean, it kind of reminds me about how white people will sometimes in the US say, gosh, I'm so tired of hearing about racism. Well, how tired do you think people are of experiencing it? You might be tired about hearing about genocide, but how tired do you think they are of living it? It's an absurd way to center yourself. That's really disgusting. But I want to let folks know where they can follow you. You're on Instagram at KHAL, Dr. Khalid Khalidi. And is there anywhere else that you'd like to let people know where to follow you or where to get information?
I'm not very keen on social media. Like, I have the Instagram just for the sake of it. I don't have other social media. But yes, people can reach out and they can communicate with me. I am more than happy to provide intel, to provide insight, and to answer their question if they have any questions about it. Whatever I can do to help my people, as they say.
Thank you so much, Dr. Khalidi. I really, really appreciate it. And again, I'm honored that you were able to sit down with me.
This honor and pleasure is all mine, as we say. May you be forever blessed and highly favored.
Likewise. And may you get some rest, and may you have many days ahead of you of beauty and joy.
We hope so, all of us, inshallah, in good deeds, as they say. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S., from Maui to New York, and you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time. It's a dirty game, maintain my reign for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. We won, the people together can overthrow.
habitualize alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love of lift up brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got that love of lift your brothers and your sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future we want.
Smash, crash, bash, bash, blast the system. We want it, get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want to crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. Yeah, we want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
We got the love.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programs.